Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend, plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did,
so wise you are,
was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Strangers and Aliens Podcast. I am one of the three hosts. I'm Ben, and then with me also is Steve.
Hey, everybody.
Dr. Jace is not here because we have another person taking that third slot, and that is John Lewis.
Hello.
And John is here. We're going to interview him about his newest book, Alienation, which is book two in the Chaos Trilogy. And we're going to talk a little about that, probably do a little geeking out, because we like doing that. And from what we were talking about before the podcast started, it sounds like we're on the same wavelength on a lot of different things here. So, John, glad to have you with us.
I appreciate you having me on. This is great.
So, first, if you would just maybe introduce yourself to our listeners, if they don't know you, which is possible, it's a big world, so if you just quickly introduce yourself and maybe kind of tell us what you've been doing and what you've done in the past, but what you're doing right now also.
Sure. Well, right now I'm watching the Phoenix Suns take on the Atlanta Hawks on my TV while I'm talking to you guys. They're up by 11 if anybody wants to know.
I didn't mean quite so immediately what you're doing.
Okay, so maybe on a bigger scale.
I'm lifting the can to my mouth and about to take a – no, I've just taken a sip.
I decided that I didn't really like working for other people that much. So so I decided I'd try to do something on my own. And the least amount of overhead is a laptop, which is a great business starter. And I like to make stuff up. So I decided to write stories. So so right now I am writing a series of novels with Thomas Nelson for kind of geared to the young adult crowd. But I like to write for kids of all ages, I say, because that's the kind of books I read anyway, is young adult and middle grade. So doing that, writing another middle grade series, it's kind of a, I guess you can call it urban fantasy, but it's kind of like fantasy into our world. So a little bit on the Harry Potter genre, I suppose, a little bit. But And then had been doing some writing for Wildstorm, a former subsidiary of DC that recently closed its doors and kind of folded into the DC proper with their reshuffling. And spent a lot of time doing that and actually working on a fun project right now with a very well-known toy manufacturer that I'm on an NDA that I can't talk about too much, but totally pumped about that too.
Cool.
Nice. All right. Well, so which came first, novels or comics for you?
Well, my passion is for comics for sure. Like, if I had to pick two, like one of the two that I could do, it would be comics all day long. When I was about 8 years old, I drew my very first comic book character that was basically, I took a DC Who's Who, which is like a printed version of Wikipedia for DC Comics that they used to put out. So, I guess in the vernacular today. And I kind of traced over Aquaman, who I know we talked earlier. One of your favorite characters was Aquaman.
So yes, he is.
My very first action figure I ever got was a DC Superpowers Aquaman. So
I had that. You squeezed his arms and his legs would kick, right?
Yes. Yep.
I had a dog like that once.
He had arms to squeeze.
Yeah, he did.
So that's where it all started, and I ended up with my best friend from childhood. His name is Derek. I wrote a series called The Grey Griffins with him. It's a middle grade novel. The sixth and final one comes out in May. But we kind of came up with about 200 of our own unique characters, and we designed them and drew them and came up with character bios for them, and had plans of becoming the Image Comics before Image Comics existed, but it never came around because we were 14 and not a whole lot of 14-year-olds had the business gumption to do that. So, but yeah, but that's my passion. I mean, it started out really probably with, you know, just enjoying Super Friends, waking up on Saturday mornings when that was the only time you could watch cartoons. Yep. And really falling in love with, you know, all of the stuff that they invented and, you know, all of, you know, Kirby and Stan Lee's work with Marvel and Love the Fantastic Four and Ben Grimm and The Thing. I suppose if I was to pick one favorite hero, it'd be him. And, you know, that really just inspired me to keep to start writing my own stuff, and it kind of led into a passion for Lord of the Rings. And I kind of tied it all together and thought, well, you know, maybe I could do some of this on my own instead of just talking about it and dreaming about it. So that's where kind of I got the bug.
Very cool.
So was Grey Griffin your first, like, published work then?
Yeah, it was. So it was the first book I had written. I had, you know, gone into a career in business and marketing and became an executive at a company and, you know, just still had the idea that I wanted to do something. So I sat down with my friend at a Starbucks out here in Phoenix, Arizona area, and we just sat down and started plotting out a book. And, you know, kind of from the business side, I thought, well, my dad was an artist. He was a pianist and, you know, never, you know, was living in Des Moines, Iowa, and which is not really a music mecca. So I thought, well, I want to be a slightly more strategic in my approach if I'm going to choose an art as a vocation. So so I sat down and I said, well, you know, we kind of plotted out what are the books that are selling right now. It was like Oprah Book Club books.
Right.
Oh, yeah. And Harry Potter were like the two. And since I don't have a love story in my body anywhere to tell and vomit if I tried to do it, I decided Oprah Book Club books were not for me. So Harry Potter was close enough to like C.S. Lewis and Narnia and Lord of the Rings that I thought, well, maybe we could riff on that idea and kind of combine my childhood with all of my favorite creatures from mythology and come up with a story where, you know, monsters break into our world. And got lucky enough that we got an agent right away and book went out for auction and, you know, was able to select to work with Scholastic. And they got the books out there in the book fairs. And, you know, the very first order was like for 250,000 copies. And
whoa.
I think the first book has sold somewhere around 800,000 copies alone. It's been pretty crazy. So, yeah. So, I mean, we feel really blessed and pretty lucky with that. And, so yeah, so the Grey Griffin's my first published work.
And then along the way, then you were doing the stuff for Wildstorm, which I had looked up. And what titles did you work on with that? It looks like a lot of them are video game titles.
Yeah, so what they were looking for is, I mean, first of all, I was on a panel with Jim Lee at San Diego Comic Con a couple years back, which was pretty insane to think, wow. You know, that I was on there with him, you know, which is quite an honor. But you know, they were looking for a writer. A friend of mine, actually from out here in Phoenix, had worked in most of his life in LA in movies and TV and doing character concept design and storyboards and stuff like that. He had gone to work for Wildstorm as an editor, and they were looking for they had a partnership with Sony Online Entertainment for Free Roms, which is basically World of Warcraft for like 8 to 12 year olds. So, and I think within the first, you know, 6 months, they had like 8 million unique users, which was pretty cool. So they wanted to do a series of comic books, and, you know, he knew I had a passion for that and wanted to break in. And so I signed on with them to do 12 issues, and, you know, did pretty well and was really excited and a lot of fun. So that kind of allowed me to see a childhood dream come true, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It's similar to some of how I broke in was just because I had a friend who was an artist, and he's like, yeah, hey, try out for this. And okay, so from there then, is that where we get into the Chaos Trilogy?
Yeah, you know, I had always had the idea in my head that I wanted to write a book very loosely based on David and Goliath. You know, I have kids now who are of the age where they are reading books. Mm-hmm. And so we'd go to like a local Berean Christian bookstore and I'd try to find stuff, you know, I'd look at this in the book section and or toys and it just, you know, some of it, let's see, I'm trying to be politically sensitive and correct, but it wasn't, it didn't inspire me with its greatness. I'll just put it that way.
Wow.
It's like, and I don't mean to knock VeggieTales because I've had friends that have worked on that, but it's like, you know, the world gets Pixar, right? And Pixar is just beyond amazing, and Christians get VeggieTales. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it didn't seem like a very fair trade-off to me. And, and so it's like, well, I could either complain about it or I could try to be a part of the change. And not to say, by the way, that by any stretch of the imagination, like, does me writing Christian books, you know, equate to, you know, a Pixar level storytelling? Because it's not even close. But what I wanted to do was, you know, I'm not confusing myself with Tolstoy. I'm not the next great American novelist. But what I think I could do is spin a fun tale that entertains kids, and I think it's okay to be entertained in a way. You know, my goal is not necessarily to get real preachy with what I do, although I don't want to hide, you know, my faith and hide the fact that, you know, I believe that Christ is my Lord and Savior. But on the other hand, I don't think that you have to browbeat people with that either. I think God does the work, and when he calls people, and when they're ready to hear that call, they will. And so what I want to do is write stories that parents can trust that kids actually want to read. Because too often, books are terrible, books are boring, and there's a reason why they call, especially boys, you know, in the 8 to 15 and older, they call them reluctant readers. And they're reluctant because the books that they are forced down their throat are terrible. Right. And so, you know, I want to at least give people a Christian alternative that parents, you know, could at least say, you know what, it's a good story and I trust my kid reading it, and the kid will actually won't feel like he's actually taking medicine. He'll actually want to crack that book open and not want to put it down at night because he just wants to read one more chapter to see what's going to happen.
That's cool.
All right, Steve, you have anything you want to ask? Or
John, you're really good at this. This isn't your first interview, I can tell.
Well, I was a broadcast journalism major at Arizona State University, so I went to the Walter Cronkite School broadcasting. So I fancied myself going into either – I want to do sports play-by-play, but I wanted my first job to be like play-by-play for the Vikings. Mm-hmm. And since it didn't happen that way, I decided to try something else. So it's kind of like if I went into the military, I'd want to go in as at least a 2-star general, and I don't think it works that way. So I didn't want to move to like some podunk town of like 1,500 people because I'd already lived there growing up. Mm-hmm. So I figured if I didn't want to do that for my first job, I didn't have a big enough passion to make it a career. So I shifted gears.
That's cool. No, I used to work at a bookseller, and I would interview authors every once. Christian book distributors.
They don't have those in Phoenix.
CBD. Well, it's a
catalog and website.
Yeah, okay. Mostly online CBD. Yeah.
Well, then they do that in Phoenix.
It's international.
But yeah, let's check.
Unless Phoenix has put the kibosh on it or something like that.
No,
I don't know.
Not yet.
But I used to do interviews with some authors, and sometimes it's like pulling teeth, getting them to open up or to, you know, give you exactly what you're shooting for there. You know, you've read their book, and you're trying to lob sort of a softball in there without saying, "Hey, here's a softball question."
That must be for like the adult, like a lot of adult authors, I think, or like NPR authors are my favorite. Like the authors that get interviewed on NPR, you know, are like the people that give authors a bad name because they all talk like this and they love to hear their own voices and read their own works. And like, get over yourself. You're an author. You put your pants on the same way and, you know, you go to the bathroom like everybody else. So just relax, chill, you know, just be a normal person. So luckily, like people that write young adult and middle grade stuff are usually pretty cool and pretty outgoing. Like I have some friends, Shannon Hale, who writes a series called The Princess Academy, and Brandon Mull, who writes a series called Fable Haven, that both of them are New York Times bestsellers, and they live up in Salt Lake, and they used to do improv in college. They are just awesome. So I have a lot of good friends who are luckily the type A's, who are a little more gregarious and outgoing than the introspective kind of people that like to live in a cave and, you know, not talk to other human beings.
That's cool. So you mentioned Lord of the Rings. You mentioned you know, some of your influences there. Who would you say would be some of your influences? Spiritually with your creative stuff, and or, you know, it could be someone who didn't do any fiction, but, you know, it influenced you spiritually anyway. Looking at the comic section, the comic side of your work, who would be some of the influences there?
Well, so J. Oswald Sanders from A Christian Worldview is an author that I just love his work. Oh my gosh, I just can't believe I just forgot the title. Spiritual Leadership.
Spiritual Leadership.
J. Oswald Sanders, I think, is a book that every Christian should read. I think it's absolutely incredible. There's another book out called Prodigal God, which is kind of a hotter one of those little kind of smaller form books that was absolutely incredible. The author's name escapes me for now. But, you know, really, to be honest with you, the only Christian fiction author I've ever been able to read and really find that I enjoy, at least classically while I was a kid growing up, was C.S. Lewis and the Narnia series. And
no relation?
Yeah, no, I wish there was. I mean, my initials are actually, that's why I used them for the middle grade books. It's J.S. Lewis. So mm-hmm. it's like, so, you know, people confused me and thought I was his grandson or, you know, great-great-grandson or whatever. I was cool with that. But I co-wrote those with somebody else, and his name started with B, so he got listed first. Which kind of hacked me off a little bit, because I'm like, now I don't get to be first. And it's like, I wanted to be like right next to C.S. Lewis on the bookshelves. I would have thought that would be pretty cool. But instead, we're stuck in the B's, which I guess is cool. Although, to be honest with you, I kind of want to write under an assumed name like Aardvark. So in every Barnes & Noble in America, it's like double A first. So like nice. Aaron Aardvark would be perfect, so I'm always like top left.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see. That doesn't quite work out. So, yeah, I don't read a lot of Christian fiction stuff. I mean, I've read there's a new series out by Andrew Clavin, the Homelander series, which is pretty good. So it's kind of like a little bit like Jason Bourne, but a teenager. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I've actually got to read those in the manuscript form, which I think are pretty awesome. So, you know, most of the stuff I read, though, from a Christian worldview is more of just like stuff on theology. Okay. You know, comic book influences, you know, there's a long time I got out of it. And thanks to the 90s and Image Comics, I got kind of tired of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big Rob Liefeld fan from, his artistic standpoint. You know, right. It's when my kid can draw proportionally this and she's 11, the same as Rob Liefeld, then I don't understand half, you know, but he's got a big fan following, you know, so that's cool. But, so I got out of it for a long time. And, you know, plus you're busy chasing girls and stuff in high school, which, you know, guys have this weird, you know, hormonal attack when they just become idiots for a while, which I did as well. So comics did not make me attractive to the opposite sex, I found out. So I kind of had to hide that and stick to the athletic side. So once I matured and got past that stage, I kind of got back into it. And now there's so much out there now that's just amazing. You know, there's so many good authors, like this guy Rick Remender, who used to work at Fox Animation Studios out here in Phoenix, but he's writing X-Force right now. I think he's super talented. Jason Aaron writes some decent stuff. A lot of the stuff, it just gets too dark for me. Yeah. But there's some really, like, Jonathan Hickman, who's writing Fantastic Four right now, is just beyond brilliant. Sometimes it gets a little too heady, but he blows me away. A buddy of mine's name is Phil Hester. I think one of the most underrated graphic novel of all time.
Yeah.
He did from, it's called The Coffin.
The Coffin.
And James Cameron actually owns the rights to that. And Del Toro was attached to be the director, and you know, for a long time. But you know, with Hollywood, you know, everything's hurry up to slow down. But
right.
There's just so much, you know, good art out there. And mostly I buy for the art, but lately I've been trying to buy a little bit more for the writers. Like there are some guys, I won't mention their names, but they work for Marvel and write like 34 Avengers titles. That, you know, like some of the most boring talking head books I've ever read in my life. You know, so I go more for the action. I like the old school stuff. It's like punching and, you know, big guys in spandex punching each other and knocking each other out. But to me, that's a comic book. I don't need to be, you know, challenged mentally too much. There's some good stuff out there. I mean, even, let's see, there's a friend of mine, Andy Parks, out of Kansas. He wrote the Truman Capote story in graphic novel form, which was just awesome. So there's some good stuff out there that's, you know, kind of non-superhero, but I'm one of those kind of old school superhero guys. You know, I listened, you know, when I was in high school, I listened to music on the radio. I wasn't like the indie guy. So I'm a little more mainstream in my days. I'm not like the super hip, cool dude.
That's cool.
All right. Well, real quick, would you, do a quick, I don't want to call it a sales pitch, but, just kind of tell our listeners what the Chaos Trilogy is about. And, you know, specifically Alienation, which is, it's out now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Just came out in January. So, I mean, the sales pitch would be I have three beautiful little girls and a wife, and they cost me a lot of money because they eat the house. So in order to keep those things, I would really appreciate if everybody went out and bought Alienation and Invasion right now. Like, seriously.
I need to start using that.
Like put this podcast on pause. Or you could actually probably just pull up a browser while you listen if you're on your computer and buy them. And multiples, too, would be great. Doubles.
Yeah.
You know, collector's items, you know.
But, stocking stuffers.
That's the pitch I need to start using. I need to put pictures of my kids on my table at conventions.
Starving.
And say, you know, hey, buy my book because look at these five young children that are just
forks
beautiful.
Forks in hand, empty plates.
Yes, you really need to sell a lot.
I do.
Actually, just bring them and have them sell them for you. Then, you know, but make sure their noses are just a little bit runny. You know, don't get super nice clothes.
Just a dab of dirt on their nose and on one cheek.
I think it'll work.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so the Chaos series. So I'm a big, you know, I know. Okay, so this is like a Christian podcast, but so I'm even uncomfortable saying this, but I'm a big Hellboy fan. I love Mike Mignola, but I like the idea of because I think I never read the comic book. I just watched the movie. Uh-huh. And I love the Nazi hunting aspect of it. I just think it's so cool. I'm like a secret society of like monsters hunting, you know, that are the good guys. And I love that idea. So so I kind of got it a little bit from that. So, you know,
if you get past the, you know, this is an actual demon that they found and they, you know, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of his stuff is it holds pretty orthodox, well, Catholic Orthodox, but you know it doesn't stray too far into, you know, heresy or anything like that. It's,
yeah, I don't think it does. It's, yeah, if you can get past the point that the hero is a demon, you know,
yeah,
so then which I just kind of ignore that part. I just kind of selectively just, you know, root for it. It's just anybody hunting Nazis is cool by me. So I think that's kind of fun storyline.
Yeah, Nazis World are War so II. Bad, even the devil doesn't like them. Is that
exactly
the message behind Hellboy?
Yeah, it's like my grandfather fought in World War II, and he was he fought in something called the Battle of the Bulge, which was like during Hitler's last push in the Ardennes Mountains up in Belgium and France, and he was actually captured by the Nazis. So I'm like a huge World War II buff and do a lot of study on that. So anytime I can fuse that in my stories, I do. So basically, Chaos, which is the book series, it stands for the Central Headquarters Against the Occult and Supernatural. And it was basically kind of a secret branch of the military that started during World War II to fight against Hitler's occult forces. And so the main character's grandfather, and this kind of ties into my comic book and pulp passion, was a part of the very first American troops that would have fought against Hitler's like wolfmen and, you know, Nazi robots and stuff like that.
Nazi robots.
Yeah, so he flies around in a jetpack. So he's a lot like the Rocketeer, but think of like a whole battalion of Rocketeers kind of in army fatigues, you know, fighting against, you know, Nazi wolfmen. So his grandfather was that. And so they've actually, in the story, created kind of propaganda through comic books, created this character called the Phantom Flyer. So the Phantom Flyer would have been like a little bit like the Rocketeer. And so he has this whole comic series where he fights all these different bad guys from, you know, mostly against kind of like the early World War II comics. And so that kind of goes away and for a while. And, you know, we defeat the Nazis, and the Nazis are really these shape-shifting aliens. And so what happens is since they realize they can't win by brute of force, they're going to take their time because they're long-lived, and they're going to defeat us. And they know money is power. So they have this big multinational corporation that they try to create to kind of, you know, rule the world through that. And a part of it is biotech. And so they create these chips that they actually implant in people's heads, and they think it's, and this is really a technology that exists, that people are putting biochips around the clavicle that, you know, emit a frequency that's supposed to help people with epilepsy. And so I kind of piggybacked on that, but instead of actually, you know, helping people with epilepsy, which they did, they also kind of turned you into kind of sleeper cell assassin types that they can basically remote control and make you do whatever they want you to do. So they're trying to take over the world through that way. So kind of that brings us up in the modern day. So the Nazis are kind of went to hiding and went through business. And so the Phantom Flyer's grandson kind of gets pulled into it, and he becomes the David character, kind of this unassuming kid who, you know, instead of a shepherd, he's a surfer kid from San Diego. And instead of playing a lute or a lyre or a harp, he plays the guitar and kind of just dreams on the beach. He's still a good-looking kid, kind of small. You know, girls like him, but he's very unassuming, kind of the youngest of eight brothers. So it's very loosely based on like what a David would be, and, you know, kind of being pulled into something bigger than he is. And really, it's not about greatness; it's about availability. You know, are you going to, you know, be available for the call? And when the call comes, are you going to be brave enough to answer that call? You know, rise above yourself. Like, you know, the guys from World War II, you know, it's not that they were necessarily great in and of themselves. They did great things because they didn't back down when they had to. And that, to me, is a real hero. I mean, that, to me, you know, they weren't these big, huge, muscle-bound, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger types, which I love those 80s movies. I mean, they were just real guys that, you know, did things that were extraordinary. And yep. That's what I wanted this book to be about, is kind of that underdog, you know, kind of the David character that it does extraordinary things because, you know, he's going to answer his calling, you know, when God calls, and he's going to be available to that. So that's kind of the backbone of the series. Alienation is the component of the story where, you know, the main character, Colt, has a best friend who would be the Jonathan character, and his name is Oz. He's kind of this big, strapping, you know, muscular kid who, from my learning, you know, Saul was chosen because he was, you know, the tallest and the greatest warrior. I think I read somewhere he's supposed to be about 6'4", which was pretty tall for back then. Right. And that's why he was supposed to fight Goliath. It was like the biggest dude against the biggest dude, and he backed out. So, you know, I would imagine, you know, if you're the son of that guy, you're going to be kind of big and strapping too. So I wanted this kid to be basically born to be a soldier, born to be the super elite. And he's going to be kind of the main character's right-hand man. Well, his father, like Saul, gets jealous of the David character. So, you know, this is all about his best friend's dad, basically, who heads this chaos organization trying to kill him, you know, and try to make it look like somebody else did, because
right.
He's scared that he's going to, you know, usurp his authority one day. And so I love the intrigue of kind of, you know, what would you do if your best friend's dad was trying to kill you when you were a 16-year-old kid? That'd be pretty overwhelming and pretty crazy. So I use that as kind of the backdrop for this book. So it kind of follows that path.
Cool. Nice.
All right. So everyone, don't forget, John has three lovely children, lovely daughters. So all that he just said, you didn't need to hear at all because you knew the other fact. But all right, well, let's switch gears just a little bit then. And, you know, just from the 5 minutes we spoke before we started recording, I can tell this is going to be kind of a fun conversation, because there's a lot of things that you mentioned and that you were talking about that was just like, oh yeah, me too. Oh yeah, me too.
So wait, the part where I say that I wear tights around the house?
Yeah, that part.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to, you know,
and
tell
the prancing.
People I was going to post prancing. Those pictures on Facebook of me, but
oh, always with the prancing.
Yeah. So, okay. So, yeah, so our last episode was about TV shows that have been canceled too soon. And just some favorites, and you mentioned a series that no one has brought up yet.
Yeah, surprisingly, because it fits perfectly in. It's not like, you know, some alternate genre type thing. It's, I mean, it's The Flash.
So it was awesome.
Yeah,
were you a big fan of that show, or was it just because that was the only thing on that was kind of going along with your appetite?
Yes, I mean both. I mean, I actually thought, you know, I mean, it's almost going to be impossible to pull off something, you know, kind of superheroic, but I thought the costume was cool. I always thought the Flash costume was cool anyway, so I go, like, my favorite heroes are usually based on how they look more than how they act or anything, so I thought it was pretty tight. I mean, I did think it was pretty cool stuff, so I mean, you know, there's a little bit of hokiness to it, but I kind of missed it, so I was really disappointed that it only lasted a season.
Yeah. I agree with you about some of that with the visuals, because like when I was a kid, two of my favorite superheroes, I knew nothing about them except for what they looked like, and that was Firestorm and Dr. Fate. Those guys just have some of the coolest costumes.
Dr. Fate does have an awesome costume. Yes, yeah. I have one of his action figures up in my from the Kingdom Come series. I have that up in my nice. Actually, and also from what was the one that Darwin Cook did with the Justice
New Frontier?
New Frontier. I have that figure up there too. It's awesome stuff.
Well, I had a comic with him in it with Batman. It was a Brave and the Bold, and it was a team up, but they never actually met each other in the book. And I couldn't tell what in the world this guy could do. He was just this guy with an awesome helmet.
Yeah.
And, you know, the blue and gold. And then there he is in his tower talking to himself, I think. I don't know. And then Batman wins his last battle and gets help from Dr. Fate because a picture falls off the wall and hits the guy on the head. like it's just this. It really felt like an old time radio drama.
That's pretty cool. Heroic,
you know.
Yeah,
but yeah. So I that visual thing. What are superheroes? Like if you could write any superhero from any company, what would you like to just tackle? And what appeals to you from a writer's standpoint? And maybe the visuals are part of that, but
yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, that's the I just want to write my favorite stuff. So I would love to tackle Alpha Flight one day. I would love to, and I would like to say to do it the right way. Except for this time, they did do it the right way, but it only lasted 8 issues, just because sales weren't where they needed it to be, which totally stunk. But I mean, they had Greg Van Lente and Greg Pak. Or wait, no, Van Lente. That's not Greg. Is his first anyway? But Greg Pak, Van Lente, and Dale Eaglesham was drawing, and Dale Eaglesham is one of the tops in the game, and I mean, it's still only lasted 8 issues, so I don't know what they have to do to make Alpha Flight pertinent. I mean, it has a big cult following, and a lot of people love it, but
perhaps one thing they could do is make it not Canadian.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a strike right there, and
I guess so. Yeah, you maybe know, just
American audiences aren't that interested in Canada.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's pretty true. It's sadly true. But I would love to at least write Sasquatch from that. Maybe have a guest appearance. I love the Fantastic Four. I would love, like, before I die, I have to write a published story with Ben Grimm in it, at least just one. Like, I will not be complete unless I do. And if I have to go, like, just sit in the offices at Marvel and just until they let me write it once because I'm just crazy, then I'm cool with that. On DC's side, I would love to write the Red Tornado. I like kind of the, like, offbeat guys on the DC. My two favorite DC characters are Red Tornado and Hawkman. So, and I think Adam Strange is kind of cool, too. I've kind of grown a fondness to him in recent years. You know, so something with that would be pretty awesome. But I actually pitched and almost got through, and it should have, on the Superman-Batman story. They really loved the pitch that I did. But they asked me, you know, do I want to write, you know, kind of all-ages comics for younger kids, or do I want to write the adult stuff? And I said both. And they said, well, right now it doesn't really work that way. So so I went with the younger stuff just because I thought that would be more my sweet spot. But you know, there's a part of me that's kicking myself in the rear end because Red Tornado would have been actually the star of the Batman Superman comic that I did. It was like a three part series, and wow, would have been a lot of fun.
Nice.
One day I'll get that shot again.
Now, is it difficult for you to, like, when you're writing Alien Nation, a novel like that, is it do you find it? I'm trying to put this in a way that makes sense.
please do, Steve.
Put it this way. Sometimes when I talk to people who are writers and I read their stuff, they have a lot of explicit stuff in there. It could be, you know, graphic in content, or it could be just words. And these may be people of, you know, maybe they go to church, maybe they claim to be Christian or something. But they say that to make the story seem real, you have to include these real things because they exist in real life, and people
Yeah, that's a good question. I've thought about that a lot. Like, you know, I sit on a lot of panels at Comic Cons and different, you know, writing conferences or whatever, and you know, get asked this sometimes. And I can't think of a situation in a young adult or middle grade comic book novel where I would feel the need to do that, to be edgy or to be true to what teens are. I just don't think that's true. I think you can still get the point across without doing it.
Right.
And it's just not who I am and not who I want to be. Now, the difference might be if I wrote a movie or a book about World War II,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to be a little more authentic to that storyline.
Right.
I'd have to think it through. And I'd have to go back and watch Saving Private Ryan again, because that would be about, I think, a pretty true tone and tenor. And also Band of Brothers. I thought that Pacific kind of went off the deep end a little bit in terms of the level of gore and language and some of the sexual content that I had in it that I didn't think mm-hmm. was as necessary yeah. as it needed to be. But you know, I think in a war movie, for it to be a little bit authentic, you know, I could perhaps see fudging a little bit on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even like the violent level in Braveheart, I mean, the audience wasn't kids, it was adults.
Right.
And I thought it was pretty true to probably what it would have been back then. I didn't think they were necessarily glorifying violence. I thought they were kind of, I mean, even think about The Passion, you know, when Mel Gibson did that, there's a lot of people that complained about the violence when Christ was getting whipped and, you know, parts of his flesh were being ripped off, but yet, you know, to me, that just, you know, really underscored even more so, very visually and viscerally, you know, what my sin did to Christ. And so I think in some instances, okay, you know, in terms of the language stuff, man, I'm not going to say I'm perfect and I've never said anything that I regret, but I just don't know that I ever want that in print, and I want to glorify that to kids. So I don't know. Right. It'd be really situational. It'd have to be a pretty rare instance where I think that would be appropriate, but off the top of my head, outside of a war book, you know, where soldiers probably would have talked that way, I just don't see it happening.
That's cool. Now, in your books, I know some writers, I do this especially. When I have characters, I want them to seem a little bit more real, especially to me. I'm like a word person. I like words and I like etymologies and things like that. And I will name characters certain things, you know, very certain things, and because their names mean something. And I might never go into exactly what the word means while I'm writing the story, but to me anyway, writing it, that name, since it has that weight to it, that meaning to it, it sort of pulls that character through to where I want it to be at the end. Do you do that with your names when you name characters?
I wish, you know what, to be honest, I'm one of those people that, like, even with my own kids, like, we didn't name them to actually have meaning at all. Like, we named them because we thought it sounded cool. What I find myself doing is I just named, you know, I mean, what I might do is, so I'll decide what kind of what ancestry I want a character to be, and I will, you know, assuming they're human, and I'll go on, you know, websites that have, you know, so if I pick Scandinavian, I might, you know, from maybe from Norway, and I'll look, you know, is there like authentic Norwegian names for this kid's ancestry, and what does that last name mean? And if it, you know, means farmer, but the kid needs to be kind of a really tough guy, then I might not go with it. But yet, if it is really just has a ring that I love, I might just ignore that altogether. So sometimes I will, like, you know, especially with some characters, maybe with German names. Like, I even toyed around with, like, using the name Faust, which I thought was a little bit overdone, you know, yeah. But I wanted a German character. So, you know,
it's
I
like
will,
naming the bad woman Jezebel.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, but if it, you know, if it has a ring to it and it still makes sense that the word means something, that I'll go with it. But, man, I'm pretty shallow. I will, unfortunately, you know, go with how it sounds in my ears. Before I go, you know, what drives the character's name.
Right.
Yeah, because, like, originally before my main character in the Chaos series, his name is Colt McAllister, and I picked it because I like, you know, the C and the C together. I like the ring to it, the sound. But originally, so he was going to be a high school quarterback instead of a surfer. So, you know, I thought Colt the Gunslinger, you know, if you're a quarterback, it's a good nickname to be a gunslinger, and Colt's right. Perfect for that. But, you know, then I ended up just switching it last minute, but I still like the name Colt. It had grown on me, so I stuck with that, but switched him to a surfer kid. So
now, Colt McAllister has a great pulp sound to it, though.
Yeah, yeah, you see, I kind of like that old stuff. Like, you know, I don't know. A lot of my main characters will have their first and last names will start with the same name, which can be a little hokey, but it's easier for people to remember.
Yeah, it's a mnemonic device. It works. We have a... This is slightly off topic. We have a television station up in the Boston area where I am, and they will use alliteration all the time for anything. It can be a tragedy or a puppy story or something, and it's always alliterated. And I just look at my wife and I'm like, why do they do that? You do that because you want to call something, you know, you want someone to remember this. Who cares about all this, every single 28 stories that you're going to do this half hour, and you want everyone to remember every single one through alliteration? It just doesn't make sense, and they do it all the time. I don't even watch it anymore. It's just...
Yeah, I gave up on local news a long time ago.
But in stories like this, when you have that iconic character, that works. You know, Colt McAllister, you're going to remember that. Just, it's nice.
Yeah, you got to have a ring to it. You know, yeah. It's pretty, you know, back to the comic book thing I had. So a lot of times my friends who are in the comic book industry will do like pinups for each other. And I like to draw, but I'm not nearly as good as them. Maybe if I did it like all day, every day, I might be able to, in 6 months or so, catch up to being fairly decent. But so I had a bunch of people do pinups for me. So Todd Nock, he's a brother in Christ, but also drew the Spider-Man Obama issue that sold like 4 million copies.
Oh yeah,
so he does a lot of Spider-Man stuff. He did a pinup for me. That's actually we got to put in the back of the book. It's pretty cool.
The little cell phone screens.
Yeah. So yeah, in the first book I did, it was more of like on parchment stuff, like stuff that would have been sketches from World War II brought to today.
Right.
So this one, I figured since this book was more focused on modern day, I did it as like a digital sketchbook. So a digital sketchbook on paper. So pictures of iPhones with you know image shots on it. So yeah, his was the first one. It's a Colt flying through the air, catching a you know big giant waspy looking alien creature.
Yeah. Now in your book, you have at least one named alien, Giru Ba.
Yes.
And did you come up with sort of like an alien language where these words make sense in it, or how did you throw some words together?
In high school, I actually was able to talk to girls despite the fact that I played Middle Earth role playing game and could speak to some level of degree Quenya, which is the high elf.
Nice.
Language spoken by the Noldor elves. So luckily I've forgotten most of it. So I, you know, but, you know, so sometimes that was really important to me. Like my Middle Earth role-playing character was Morikala, which stood for dark light, because I wanted to be a half-elf. Like I always like good guys that are kind of, you know, more like Wolverine, although Wolverine's totally overdone. I'm not a big Wolverine fan, but I like the kind of, you know, good guys who will cross the line a little bit and not be such pansies. So he's not a pansy. So, but I, you know, I didn't. So what I did is I thought about like other alien races in other genres that I enjoy, and I wanted to kind of have it have a sound and a ring to it like that. So I'll look them up, and then I'll kind of twist around and play with them and kind of just hear them in my head and try to figure out words that'd be kind of in that vernacular or pretty close to it that already exist in that, because my brain doesn't always work. So, you know, so, and I try to make it kind of have a sound, you know, back to, the, you know, kind of the sound of the words, like, you know, sound heavy, you know, using the letter X to end in something, or, you know, hard consonants to go with like the bigger creatures, and something kind of a little too, like a Giruba to go with a more elegant creature, because it sounds more elegant, almost like it would be Elvish or maybe Native American or something that would just be a little more, you know, kind of elegant for an elegant creature. So I try to make the sound of the words fit the style of, or the kind of the physical structure of the alien that it goes with.
Cool.
Okay, so you've mentioned Lord of the Rings a lot. And yeah. I got to ask you, are you looking forward to The Hobbit this December?
I am a lot. You know, I was really, like, I was so pumped about Lord of the Rings when it first came out, the movies. Yeah. And that's probably, so I first read that book when I was in seventh grade, The Hobbit. And I mean, I had watched the cartoon when I was a kid in the Midwest where I lived. Every Thanksgiving they showed
nice
the Hobbit cartoon, and they showed the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe cartoon, like back to back.
The so, greatest adventure.
Oh, Steve, please not.
Is all yours to take.
Love it. Yes, the old Rankin Bass cartoon, and I have all those on DVD. Nice. But
I just watched that with my kids, and they liked it.
Yeah, my kids call those kind of cartoons olden days. So, yeah, they
my kids don't know better because we don't have cable. So
there you go.
It's whatever dad puts on the DVD.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. So so I actually had that. Like I had that book on record. Like and so record.
Yes.
It was like a little 8-inch by 8-inch book, and
it's
and
so like I have a twin. I had that. That was awesome.
Yes. Yeah, so that was like my first. I got that La Chic. Or the Freak, La Freak by Chic or something, and the Charlie Daniels Band, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. Those are my first three. I bought them in one clump, which is kind of a bizarre grouping of music and books. But so that kind of got me hooked on it. I actually read the novel in seventh grade and have read it basically every year since then, which I'm not going to say how many, but it's long enough. And so I had a humongous influence in my life, and I love it. And, you know, the movies were – uh-oh, that's my dog, sorry. It means my wife is coming home. My ferocious Tinkerbell is her name. She is a Maltese, about a 6-pound Maltese that is a devastating creature. So, so you know, I was really disappointed actually with the movies when I first left the theater after looking forward to it. Like, he ruined the entire thing.
Really?
Well, so the Uruk-hai, like looking like they were overstuffed sausages, was really bizarre to me. The way that the goblins kind of just like, or the orcs, you know, they crawled up like spiders all over. I was like, what is he doing with some of this stuff? But after I settled down, I thought about it for a few days. I'm like, you know what? For taking the amount of material he had, he still remained very true to it. He did an amazing job. So I love them more now than I did when I very first saw the first one.
Yeah, I think what he did with some of the characters, although he retold the whole story, and you're right. I mean, he took an immense amount of stuff, but you know, redoing the hobbits, making them more comic characters instead of the, you know, very hardy little individuals that just happen to like staying at home, and now they're just, you know, out of the fish out of water type thing. And now they're sort of a goofy type of band, and they're you know, they're changing from goofy to cool. There are little things like that.
History seriously, which is what actually made the films palpable. I mean, many people like the it all looks like it's made in the Sci-Fi Channel, which is why these things fail. But the Harry Potter movie franchise and the Lord of the Rings movie franchise, they actually took them seriously and, you know, muted the tones and made them more dramatic. And wow, you know, they succeeded. Amazing, isn't
it? They gave Fantasy Worlds the Star Wars treatment.
Yeah.
Where they made it look lived in. And
yeah, it was awesome. Well, okay, it was awesome. I would change two things, though. Elrond, you know, drove me nuts because all I could picture was The Matrix and him saying Mr. Anderson.
Yeah.
I hate it when they take like guys from pop culture and put them in like – I like no-name British actors in these things.
And
Liv Tyler was like the worst casting ever. All I could picture is like, you know, her dad singing Love in an Elevator while She's on, I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? This is ridiculous.
No, all I could think of was her in Armageddon and just her dad singing, and I don't want to miss a thing.
It's the worst. And I'm like, and plus, Glorfindel is like my favorite all-time Lord of the Rings character, and like they melded him with her character and made like buffed up the love story, which is barely in the books. And it, that kind of stuff kind of rubs me wrong. But I mean, that's such a nitpicky, like, who is going to be upset because Glorfindel isn't Lord of the Rings? I might be the only human being alive that feels that way.
Glorfindel, but I was. No.
He was so important, right? Because he is like, he was like the one who didn't go with the group, because he alone could have probably fought the ring race and defeated him. But it wasn't about might. It was about, you know, kind of their small team banding together. And so it's like, that was like, oh, but they took that away from me. So I'm like, whatever. I get Liv Tyler instead, which is just awful.
You poor man.
Nothing against her, but I just don't want her in Lord of the Rings.
So are you familiar with the guy who's playing Bilbo? I can't remember his name now.
Yeah, I don't know much about him.
He was Tim on the British version of The Office.
Oh, was he? See it now? Yeah. I tried to get that a little bit. I loved, past tense, the American version of The Office. It's definitely jumped the shark about two seasons ago, and this season is just, it's not what it needs to be. But I need to rewatch those because I think they're, you know.
The British version is pretty harsh. I mean, there's some pretty foul stuff in there.
Oh, is it? All right. Well, maybe I won't.
But then he also played Arthur Dent on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie.
The movie.
And
I still haven't seen that either. So.
And then he also played Watson on the new Sherlock from the BBC.
Okay.
And so he's like hitting these super huge, to American audiences anyway, British pop culture icons of Watson, Arthur Dent, and now
and
Bilbo.
And,
but okay, so you wouldn't have a problem with him then watching him as Bilbo because you're not real familiar with him.
Yeah. So luckily he's not no baggage for me. As long as his dad wasn't in a rock band, I'm.
Which I can't promise, but. I can probably promise you've never heard of the rock band if he was.
Yeah.
I tell you, when I first heard that that Peter Jackson was directing The Hobbit, I was really excited. And then when I heard he wasn't going to, I stopped being excited. But then when I heard Del Toro was going to do it, oh my goodness, that was – I love Pan's Labyrinth. I really
– I did. So, but here's my problem with that, though. It's like – all of his movies look like he just like cut and paste the same creatures. And it's like I think it's cool and I think it's beautiful, but I'm like, I don't want to see him just cut and paste the same creatures from Pan's Labyrinth and from Hellboy and then cut and paste them into Lord of the Rings. Like,
Don't you think we would have some sort of an influence on him with that? I mean, with their, they have that whole department of, is that how you say it? Weta? Weta?
Yeah.
I mean, they would have some influence there as well.
I hope so.
But I mean, he's not involved anymore.
Yeah, we don't have to worry
about the screenplay.
Because
then, when I found out he wasn't involved, I got disappointed again. And then, Jackson's back in. So
as long as I kind of wanted Peter Jackson to see it all the way through, I was pretty happy about that. Yeah. So, have you been watching the like the little video blogs that they're doing along with it?
At this point, I'm trying to stay away from anything. I mean, I love the trailer and I watched it over and over. And then I thought, I want to stay away. And let this, I know the story, so the story is not going to be spoiled for me. But I'd like to just kind of experience as much as I can. And when the full-length trailer comes out and we get closer to the release, I think I'm going to close my eyes if I'm ever in the theater. Which I did that with Avatar. Yeah, with Avatar, I didn't watch
The Last
any.
Airbender by Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was awesome.
He didn't want to pick up any of the really deep plot points and the really, intrinsic themes that Avatar was really trying to explore.
Well, I knew it was going to be a visual feast.
It's called Dances with Wolves, so if you saw that, you saw Avatar.
I wanted to not see anything. I wanted to go ahead and experience whatever I was seeing. And I liked it, but I fully admit it's a visual movie. It's all about the visuals.
It was. I tell you what, I saw it on the IMAX, and it was visually just – it felt like I was on a flight simulator ride. I actually kind of liked the movie,
And it was the most beautiful 3D I've ever seen.
It was pretty spectacular.
I wish I had brought my Walkman. Walkman. I'm dating myself now. I wish I had brought my Victrola. I wish I had brought my headphones to my cell phone so I could have, listened to something I wanted to hear instead of what was coming off the screen out of the actors' mouths. So it was beautiful visuals, but man, it was bad.
So John, any other franchises you're a fan of or books or movies or whatever. But I mean, obviously, you know, Steve and I, we're both, we love Star Trek and those kind of things. But what about you? I mean, what do you watch if you can sit down and just throw something in? Or,
well, let's see, TV, I would say right now Modern Family and used to be Fringe, but I haven't watched a whole lot of it this year. I haven't had as much time.
You know, me too. I've not followed this season. I don't know why.
I actually got to go to a party with the female actress on there at Comic-Con a couple of years ago. It was pretty cool. So now I feel like an idiot when I talked to her. I was like, couldn't form complete sentences for some reason. It was just ridiculous. But it was like,
do you like things?
Yeah, exactly. That's about how eloquent I was. So it was pretty pathetic. I embarrassed myself. But so I don't know. Like on I love Star Wars Clone Wars. I mean, if I was to pick like one TV show right now, I love that. like Lucas has done himself right, which is probably because he's not writing it anymore. But
yeah.
You know, I think it's incredible. I love that stuff. You know, and Star Wars is probably, if I was to pick like one thing that I love more than any in like fiction, it would definitely be Star Wars. And I actually got to have dinner with Peter Mayhew twice.
Wow.
So Chewbacca is like my all-time favorite character from anything. So nice. To say that I had dinner with Chewbacca is pretty cool. So I even dedicated one of my books to him.
And, really?
Like actually, like Chewbacca, not Peter, but although Peter by default. But yeah, I just decided I dedicate books to my wife, which is great. But it's like, do 8-year-olds really want to read like a sappy love dedication to somebody's wife? No. So one of my books I dedicated to Dwight Schrute. Another one I did to Chewbacca, and the last one I did to a combination of Tio Maro, who is the fictional, you know, guy who created the Red Tornado, and I think Benjamin Jacob. And I also, which was, I was running out of books in that series, so I couldn't like dedicate to DC and not Marvel, so I added Benjamin Jacob Grimm and his Yancey Street gang to the to the dedication.
Nice.
The series is about aliens and,
yes,
you know, the Thule. And I don't want to give it away if you have, you know, secret plans about them not being aliens or whatever.
They'll be aliens all the way through.
Well, don't ruin it for anybody.
All right.
Like spoiler, you just did.
What are you talking about? Spoiler alert, the aliens that I said were aliens are actually aliens.
Aliens equals aliens. Personally, I don't know how you would feel personally if there was, you know, proven to be sentient life on other planets, but what do you think would be the effect, A, on the normal, regular populace, and B, what do you think the effect would be for people of faith?
Well, I think those are great questions. You know, I think the general populace would freak out. It would not be like District 9, which, by the way, I love that movie. Mm-hmm. Although maybe it would be if they were sick and weak.
If it happened like it happened in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if they just sat back and let us put them in camps like that, then I guess we'd be okay. But if they fought back, I'm sure we'd freak. I mean, to be honest with you, I think it would be like 9/11. Like what would have happened after 9/11, where like everybody, like I remember on 9/11, I worked in Tempe, Arizona, which is Arizona State University, which is where I went to school. That's kind of what it's known for. And I was in one of the only like even semi like high rise buildings in the whole city. It was 10 stories high, and I like had this unreasonable thought that I need to get out of the 10-story building because we could potentially be targeted. As of all the buildings, you know, across the country.
Wow.
You know, my 10-story building, and, you know, it was just these unreasonable, bizarre thoughts that cross your head.
Yeah.
You know, these unreasonable fears, and I think that we would probably have it. You know what? What was that movie with Mel Gibson that he did? It actually was like a good M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Signs. Yeah.
I love that movie. I think it would be like a combination of Signs and District 9 if they really existed, in terms of how we would react. Now, what would it do to people of faith? I think it would probably shake the foundation of the faith, but I don't know that it would even necessarily be anti-biblical if it did. Now, I don't think it does, but let's say that it did. You know, I wouldn't say Christ would have gone to every planet to die, you know, for individual planets. You know, if he died for creatures with souls once and for all, and that his death here on Earth would have fulfilled, you know, the need to pay for the penalties of sin,
right?
You know, from now throughout eternity, you know, from here to, you know, the edges of space.
The Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, so you know, once and for all, what he did was good for one and good for all. But so I think it would, you know, people would probably have doubts or fears or wonder why it wasn't mentioned, or maybe they'd explain stuff like in the Old Testament, like the behemoth is maybe being an alien on Earth anyway. So who knows?
Well, but C.S. Lewis goes there with his, and basically, you know, the inhabitants of Mars are unfallen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the inhabitants of Venus are being tempted to fall. And you wonder what would have happened if Ransom had been unsuccessful on Venus and they had sinned. What would Christ have had to do?
Right.
You know, or how would that have worked? It would have been something different and unique, just like the temptation was possibly, but...
Well, you know what's interesting is there was an article in Christianity Today back when I was in college. So it was been like the early 90s, where they were saying that aliens exist, but they're actually, you know, demonic creatures that are. It was just like the weirdest. Like I was like, and one, like I had somebody I really respected, you know, who actually thought that, you know, he believed it. I was like, seriously?
And I was I heard that too. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like, and I tried to actually do a Google search for it the other day. Because I wanted to post it on Facebook if I could find it, but I couldn't find the article. Maybe I'll try to call their offices and see if I can get an old archived copy. Because that was just like the
most... Were they talking about UFOs, though?
As yeah.
Far as, like, you know, alien life as far as coming in our sphere of, you know, influence on this world, right?
Yes, yeah.
Not like if there's life on other planets, they're demons.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it was like alien, like UFOs, like stuff that we would have seen are demons. So it was kind of... So that was really fascinating. So that's why I want to go back and see if I can find it. That was kind of funky.
I think I have a book somewhere that mentions that, but I'm not sure. I'll check it out. I have a lot of books like that that would possibly mention something like that. So if I find it, I'll
shoot
you an email. Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
So, all right. Well, John, we really want to thank you for hanging out with us. And
thanks, man.
Shooting the breeze, and
I appreciate it.
Again, the book series is called The Chaos Trilogy, and the current volume, which Steve and I have read that without the first volume, and I don't think there was any problem, especially with the comic book little prelude or prologue in there, six-page comic kind of explaining the character and the concept of the world that it takes place in. But but it's book two called Alien Nation, and...
Alienation, not Alien Nation.
Yeah, Alienation, one word. And then there's also the Grey Griffin series, which would also help line Mr. Lewis's pockets for his
starving children.
Pay for my daughter's braces and food. I mean, that's really cool. And just think about really that. Pay for three weddings and three colleges, too. So just that.
So, but definitely check them out on Amazon and or your local bookstore if you still have one. So
no kidding.
Yeah.
So well, thank you again. And you have anything else you'd like to maybe add or say to our listeners before you go? Or
yeah, I just want to say I appreciate the time and had a lot of fun. So you know, it's great to hook up with other brothers in Christ who like the kind of stuff I do, and I look forward to following your blog and your video. Your podcasts, and you know, hey, if you ever need a guest co-host. And somebody's sick, you know, give me a buzz. I'd be happy to do it.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
And well, you know, have your people call our people when book three comes out.
We'll do it.
Yeah. Or are you going to do the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy that has five books? Six now with that new one.
I actually thought about it. This book was the third book, which I'm in the middle of editing right now, was getting so long. I thought, well, maybe I'll break it into two. It'd be like part one of book three. It'd be just like the Twilight movies where there's...
Well, it works for George Martin, too.
Yeah,
he started out with Song of Ice and Fire was supposed to be three volumes, and now it's going to be, six or seven, I think.
Wow.
You got a cash cow, you got to milk that thing.
Well, no, he just, you know, he's someone I've been able to spend some time with, and he just got so big. I mean, the story just grew out of hand, and now he doesn't have any, like, written notes. He's just doing it all in his head.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I admire that for sure.
But he just... It got too big, and he planned it out as a trilogy and realized, nope, it's just not going to work. And then he was able to, you know, be popular enough to pull it off. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm all about, you know, you always plan out a book, but it never turns out the way you plan it to be anyway. So you got to kind of ride the tide and see where it goes.
But I like what you're saying about the Twilight thing. I tried to do that with Time Flies. With book 7 and 8, they were supposed to be just part one and part two of the same story, but Zondervan was like, no, can't. They have to have different titles. And it was just I was sad. I was sad.
So you have to buy them, you know, sell enough books so you just buy Zondervan, and then you get to dictate it.
Yeah, I'll just buy them from HarperCollins.
I would do.
Yeah. You know, HarperCollins just bought Thomas Nelson, didn't they?
I know. They just bought my branch, too. So now they have every Christian publisher in the history of the universe.
Which well, is kind they've got the NIV and the, you know, Sondervan with the NIV. And then I think Thomas Nelson has the New King James, which are the two biggest translations. But then I don't know what they're going to do.
What's the one with the, is it the living, what's the one where it's like, you know, yo, Jesus, what up, dude? Like, what's
the message?
The message.
Yeah.
No, they actually had a Jive Bible.
Yeah,
a hippie word slang Bible. That's
what it was. Word on the street.
Yeah,
I remember as a kid, my grandma used to like collect Bibles, and like she had one that was like, you know, the 70s version of that, which was pretty trippy. So, not that, hey, whatever gets people reading the word is good, I guess.
Oh, that's just it. I mean, as I was talking to a guy, he's a professor at my college that I went to, and then I still live near it, and he goes to our church, and he worked on the New Living Translation, and he has some pretty cool insights on just why they do new translations, and part of it is to target a particular audience. I mean, they really are trying to get the word so that, you know, someone who reads at this level can understand it, and someone who prefers this style of speech can understand that. And
yeah, I had that comic book Bible that was out in the 70s, so...
The picture Bible?
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Yeah,
I think that's awesome.
Everyone who was a kid and was going to church at that time seemed like had that, or had the Sunday school papers, the sermon busters we used to call them.
Yeah.
That had they had like two or three of those stories.
Yeah.
At each one, and then also crossword puzzles and word searches and stuff.
Yeah. So. Those are all awesome.
Right. Well, you know, as you know, true to form, our last words kind of got stretched out. But as I was saying 5 minutes ago, thanks again, John, for being with us. And we really appreciate it. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I appreciate it, guys.
And so until next time, our next real official episode is we're going to be talking about zombies and Walking Dead, it sounds like, which I know, Steve, you're not necessarily looking forward to. But I think there's some interesting stuff we can talk about with that.
Yeah, so. There's other stuff that can happen.
So, until then, thanks for listening, and keep on being – I have to work on our tagline, Steve. So keep being strange and
keep
and
on working
alien-ish.
On the tagline.
I don't know. Be a strange and alienated – yeah. We should change just for this episode, change it to strangers and alienation.
Strangers
and alienation.
All right. Well, until next time, everybody, Godspeed. Thanks for listening.
God bless you.
You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Dr. Jace O'Neill, and Steve McDonald. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. We invite you to join the conversation by visiting our website, www.strangersandaliens.com, where you'll find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are @StrangeAndAlien, or like us on our Facebook page. If you'd like to email us directly, our email is podcast@strangersandaliens.com. And once again, thanks for listening.
Tinkerbell is her name. She is a Maltese, about a 6-pound Maltese that is a devastating creature.